This is not going to be a pleasant experience. You're going to see and hear things that are not going to be very nice.
Experts divide serial killing into two general types, organized and disorganized. An organized killer brings everything he needs to complete the murder. A disorganized killer improvises.
Begin. Listener discretion is advised.
For this episode, we're going back to July 1982. In July 1982, 33-year-old Larry Walters lived in San Pedro, California. From a young age, he was fascinated with balloons. He said he went to Disneyland for the first time when he was about 8 or 9. One of the first things he saw was a woman holding a bunch of helium-filled Mickey Mouse-shaped balloons. He said that he was struck with the idea that the balloons would lift him off the ground if he had enough of them. The idea stayed with him for years. It was the only thing he could think of when he served as a cook in Vietnam. In the spring of 1982, Walters decided to follow through with his plan. He said that if he didn't do it, he might have gone crazy. On July 2, 1982, Walters attached 42 8-foot weather balloons to a Sears Roebuck lawn chair. He had purchased the lawn chair for $109. He then filled the balloons with helium. He attached 13 plastic gallon water jugs to the lawn chair for buoyancy. He then strapped himself into the chair with a pellet gun, a CB radio, sandwiches, beer, and a camera. Walters planned to rise 100 feet in the air and then the wind would push him to the Mojave Desert. He would then shoot some balloons with a pellet gun to lower himself. But things didn't go according to plan. Walters quickly rose to 16,000 feet. He was spotted by two pilots flying commercial planes. They reported him to air traffic controllers. With freezing temperatures and lower oxygen levels, Walters realized he was in trouble. He started shooting balloons. He popped balloons in different spots so his chair wouldn't tip. He then put the gun on his lap. Then there was a gust of wind and it tipped the chair. The pellet gun fell off his lap. At that point, he was descending too quickly. He started dropping some water jugs to try and slow his descent. When he got close to the earth, he got tangled up in some power lines. The LAPD had to help him down. Amazingly, he was completely uninjured. Walters gave the lawn chair to a neighborhood kid in the area, Jerry Fleck. Larry Walters, who earned the nickname Lawn Chair Larry, was fined $1,500 for the stunt. After his flight, he became a minor celebrity and appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman. Sadly, Larry Walters died after shooting himself in the heart in October 1993, 11 years after his famous flight. He was 44 years old. Jerry Fleck held on to the lawn chair for over 3 decades. He then donated it to the National Air and Space Museum.
Here is a quick word from our sponsor.
We take this few seconds off to inform you, our valued loyal listener, about the best health and fitness podcast shows. From the Nespod Studios. Join us as we give you the best of the best health and wellness updates you can rely on for the treatment of chronic health problems. Classic functional medicine back to basics health tips and special updates from the best doctors in the United States of America. Check out this health and wellness podcast shows. Explore Health Talk Weekly, Healthy Lifestyle Matters, Excellent Health Digest, Healthy and Free Daily, and last but not least, Weekly Health and Fitness Corner. Also, check out Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told fiction podcast, for that real life on the go experience with the 27-year-old golden boy, who made our guest invite number one list. He tells us about his story as it happens in real time and in real life. It's Nasty Boy CC, the truest story never told. Go get a load of that happiness, because happiness is healthy as we know it. Join us every week as we continue to provide you the best of health and fitness wellness updates from around the globe. Enjoy the show.
It It's on display at the Thomas W. Hayes We All Fly Wing of the museum. In July 1982, Michael Fagan of London, England, was 31 years old. He was a married father of four. He had worked as a painter and a decorator, but in July 1982, he was unemployed. Fagan was drinking at a pub in the early morning hours of July 9, 1982. He bet several people £5 each that he could break into Buckingham Palace. The people who took the bet thought he'd never be able to get into Queen Elizabeth's palace. What they didn't know was that he had broken into the palace about a week earlier. He climbed the 14-foot perimeter wall that was topped with revolving spikes and barbed wire. He climbed up a drainage pipe and entered the palace through a window where a housemaid was reading. She was startled and ran for help. When she left, Fagan walked around the palace and sat in several chairs. He then went to the office of one of Prince Charles' staff, where he waited to be arrested. While waiting, he drank half a bottle of wine, but no one came and he decided to leave. The security guards thought that the housemaid had just imagined the intruder. On the morning of July 9, 1982, Fagan broke into the palace the same way he did the week before. He wandered around the palace. One thing he did was examine King George V's stamp collection. During a self-guided palace tour, he set off the security alarm twice. However, the security guards assumed it was glitches and turned off the alarm. Fagan then made his way to the residential area of the palace. The palace has 775 rooms. Fagan happened to walk into the bedroom of 56-year-old Queen Elizabeth II, who was asleep in bed. Fagan opened the curtains, which awoke the queen. She called security from a phone at her bedside. When no one came, she got out of bed and ran past Fagan. Then a footman came and escorted Fagan to the queen's pantry, where he gave Fagan a glass of scotch. Fagan was arrested, but he wasn't charged with a break-in. It was considered a civil matter, and the queen would personally have to press charges. But the queen never pressed charges. So instead, Fagan was charged with stealing the wine he drank during his first break-in. He went to trial and was acquitted after 14 minutes of deliberation. In October 1982, he was convicted of an unrelated car theft he admitted to while he was being interrogated after he was arrested for the break-in. He was committed to a psychiatric hospital, but he was released after a few months in January 1983. Michael Fagan's break-in is considered one of the biggest security scandals in the history of the English royal family. Many people worldwide were shocked at how easy it was for Fagan to break into the palace. In the years after making headlines worldwide, Fagan had other brushes with the law. He also sat down for several interviews. The incident was dramatized in the fourth season of Netflix's The Crown. Nagasaki, Japan is famous for being the second and the last city in the world to experience a nuclear bomb attack. At the time of the bombing, there was 263,000 people living there. In the aftermath of the bombing, which killed 60 to 80,000 people, the city was rebuilt. In July 1982, Nagasaki had a population of 450,000 people. On July 23rd, monsoon rains pounded the area. Within 7 hours, 18 inches of rain fell in the area. This led to massive mudslides in the area and caused mass destruction. A 350-year-old stone bridge that survived the atomic bomb was washed away. 20,000 cars were washed away and 53,000 people were left homeless. 299 people were killed. On July 17, 1982, the number one song in the USA was Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, which is the theme song for Rocky III. In the United Kingdom, it was famed by Irene Cara. The number one movie at the box office was the sci-fi classic E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Norma Richards was 27 on July 17, 1982, and lived in Dalston, northeast London, England. Norma lived with her three daughters, 9-year-old Samantha, 7-year-old Sarita, and 4-year-old Rodin. The two eldest girls were from Norma's previous relationship. In 1982, Norma was living with her current romantic partner and the father of Rodin, Keith Cunningham. They had been together for several years. Keith was the brother of famed soccer player Laurie Cunningham. In 1977, Laurie became the first black person to play for an English international team organized by the Football Association. In 1979, he became the first British player to sign with Spain's Real Madrid. In July 1982, Laurie was still playing for Real Madrid. On the night of July 17, 1982, Norma went out to a nightclub. That weekend, her youngest daughter, Rodin, was staying at her fraternal grandparents' home. Her two eldest daughters were at home. Two days later, on July 19th, Rodin and her grandmother went to the family's home. They found the new dead body of 27-year-old Norma Richards on the living room floor. They went upstairs to the bathroom. In the bathtub, which was full of water, were the bodies of 9-year-old Samantha and 7-year-old Sarita. The police were called. The police determined that Norma had been raped. Her underwear was lying beside her body. She had been stabbed to death. She had been stabbed twice in the neck and twice in the chest. The stabs were incredibly violent. With one of them, the stabbing weapon went through her breastbone, heart, and lung, and then came out her back. It's believed that the murder weapon was an antique bayonet which had been hanging on the wall in the living room. 9-year-old Samantha was also naked, and her body was above her sister's body in the bathtub. She had been stabbed 8 times in the neck, chest, arm, stomach, and back. Like her mother, the stabs were vicious. One went through her body and into her arm. So it's believed that she was killed with the bayonet as well. 7-year-old Sarita had been drowned. Her body disturbed the investigators because her thumb was in her mouth as if she were sucking it. Neither girl showed signs of sexual assault. On several doors, the killer had drawn the logo for the National Front, a far-right, fascist, racist organization. However, the police did not think that the extremist group was responsible for the murders. They thought that the killer drew the logos to throw them off. To the investigators, it was clear that it was a sex crime. The family had been killed 2 days before their bodies were found. It was the night that Norma went to the club. The killer either went home with Norma from the club or followed her home. Then either one or both of the girls were awakened when Norma was being raped or killed, and they were killed to eliminate them as witnesses. The police focused on friends, acquaintances, and former and current lovers of Norma. The police learned that, even though Norma was in a relationship with Keith Cunningham, she was having an affair with a man named Donovan Johnson. The police questioned Johnson for 3 days. He told them he met Norma at a mutual friend's birthday party about 9 weeks before the murders. He said they had sex twice. The second time, they had sex in her bed, and he saw a photo of Keith Cunningham. Johnson knew Keith and didn't feel right about sleeping with his partner. Norma knew that Keith would not like that she had slept with Johnson. Johnson said that Norma asked him if he had a black suit because he might have to wear it to her funeral after Keith killed her. It turned out that Donovan Johnson had an alibi for the time of the murders. He was out with friends and they confirmed his alibi. Friends of Norma also said that Keith might have killed Norma if he found out she was cheating. The police investigated Keith Cunningham, but he had an even better alibi than Donovan Johnson. When the murders were committed, Keith was about 1,000 miles away in Spain with his brother, the professional soccer player. So Keith was cleared as a suspect as well. The police continued to investigate by focusing on people in Norma's life. But they didn't make any arrests and the case went cold. It wasn't long before the murders of the mother and her daughters were forgotten. Rodin was raised by her father's parents. She said she lived a good life and had a lot of friends. Her grandparents, who were unrelated to her half-sisters, never talked about them or her mother. Also, her mother's side of the family never talked about her mother. She thought it was too difficult for them. She said that every year, on her birthday, she would cry for her mother and sisters. when Rodin was 18, she got pregnant and wanted her mother more than ever. But by then, her mother had been dead for 14 years. Another 13 years passed before the case was reopened. A lot had changed in those 27 years. In early 2009, journalist Peter Law was working on a biography of soccer player Laurie Cunningham. Laurie played in Real Madrid for 4 years. He then played a year in France, followed by a year in Leicester City in England. In 1986, he went to play for Rayo Vallecano in Spain. 2 years later, in 1988, he played 6 games for the Wimbledon Football Club in England and helped them win the FA Cup. After that, he went back to play for Rayo Vallecano in Spain. On July 15, 1989, Laurie was driving in Madrid, Spain. His car collided with a light post and he was killed. Laurie Cunningham, nicknamed the Black Flash, was 33 years old. While researching the former soccer pro, Peter Law learned that Laurie's brother, Keith, had a romantic partner who was murdered. But in his research, he didn't find out if the case had ever been solved. In April 2009, Law contacted the police to see if the case had ever been solved. It turned out that nothing had been done with the case in years. When it was reopened, DNA testing was done on the evidence. They were able to create a profile from it. It was then entered into the UK National DNA Database. It was matched to Wilbert Dice, who went by Tony. Dice had a criminal record dating back to the mid-1970s. His convictions include burglary, assault, carrying knives, and possessing a shotgun. When Dice's DNA was matched to the crime scene, he was 53 years old. So at the time of the murders, he was 26 years old. The police investigated Dice to see if they could connect him to the murders in other ways. In July 1982, Dice's mother lived a few hundred feet from where Norma and her family lived. Also, Dice was considered a passing acquaintance of Norma's partner, Keith Cunningham. Dice had never been considered a suspect because the police did not investigate Keith's friends and acquaintances. They had focused on people in Norma's life instead. In October 2009, 27 years after the murders, 54-year-old Tony Dice was arrested. In custody, he was questioned. He said that he didn't do anything to Norma. He said he considered her his sister. Then they confronted him with the DNA evidence. He then had a new story. He said they met Norma at the club and they had sex in the women's washroom. But there was a problem with this explanation. Norma's underwear was found next to her body and there was no semen on it. Another problem is that Dice's fingerprints were found on the wall of Norma's living room. It was in the area where the bayonet had been hung on the wall. The police believe that the bayonet was used to kill Norma and Samantha. When the police reopened the case, they could not get any evidence from the bayonet because it had been destroyed in 1989, 7 years after the murders. Tony Dice went to trial for the 3 murders in November 2010. The prosecution said that Dice encountered Norma at the nightclub. He either accompanied her home or followed her home. He then tried to have sex with Norma, but she rejected him. He snapped and then raped and killed her. He then killed her daughters to eliminate the witnesses. The DNA and fingerprint evidence placed him at the crime scene. Besides the DNA and fingerprint evidence, the prosecution had 3 witnesses testify. One was his ex-wife, who testified that Dice was horribly abusive. During their 18-year marriage, he attacked her 3 times with a knife. He also struck her with a hammer, dumbbells, and a bicycle chain. Another time, he threatened her with a shotgun. She recounted an incident that had disturbing similarities to the murders of Norma, Samantha, and Sarita. It happened 8 years before the murders. She had drawn a bath and then got into an argument with Dice. He held her head under the water until she thought she would die. He eventually pulled her out. He then cut her with a knife. Another person who testified was a woman who had a disturbing encounter with Dice that was also similar to the murders. It happened in 1982, the same year as the murders. Like Norma, the woman's living boyfriend wasn't home, and Dice knew that. He followed her home from a nightclub. He tried to force her to have sex, and when she stopped him, he threw her across the living room. However, she was not too badly injured, nor did he rape her. She told her boyfriend about the incident, and he confronted Dice. He slapped Dice several times. Dice did not fight back, nor did he deny the allegations. He just kept apologizing. A third woman testified about how she was attacked by Dice in 1986 when she was 19. She was pregnant with her second child. She was at home with her first child while her partner was out. Dice was friends with her partner and he came over to speak with him. When she told Dice that he was out, he asked to use the washroom. She let him in and then she went to her child's bedroom. Dice came up to her and held a knife up to her throat. He was naked, except they had black gloves on. She was terrified and didn't want anything to happen to her child, so she did everything he wanted. But this wasn't her last horrifying encounter with Dice. A few months later, while she was in the late stages of her pregnancy, she came across Dice while she was out in public. He pulled out a knife and took her to an apartment building where he sexually humiliated her. The trial lasted 3 weeks. Tony Dice was found guilty of all three murders. He was given 3 life sentences. They were whole life sentences, so he will never be released. Norma's brother, Dalton, spoke at the sentencing hearing. He said, "A light went out in our lives when Norma and the girls were murdered. Dice's imprisonment brings us some closure."
This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you. This will conclude the episode. Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please leave a comment and subscribe. Thank you.